Cassette 9, Side 2.
He answered the call from Ramsey's office and found Ramsey in the lab. The chemist had broken down the interweaving chain into a plausible configuration. Phosphorus, hydrogen, oxygen, carbon. It made sense. What was more, it fit into a class that resembled the pesticides. More sophisticated, yes, but a clear lineal descendant. Gordon smiled, still sleepy from the colloquium. "Good work," he murmured. Ramsey beamed. On his way out, Gordon passed through the glass forest of the laboratory. He had come to enjoy its rhythms. The biologists down the hall had pens of animals for their tests, and Gordon wandered down that way, feeling obscurely happy. On a cart in the hallway, there were trays. In them were heaps of gutted brown hamsters, like burst potatoes. Life in the service of life. He walked away quickly. His telephone rang at 6 p.m. as he was putting papers and books in his briefcase for the weekend. The physics building was nearly deserted and the ringing echoed. "Gordon, this is Claudia Zins." "Oh, hello, have you..." "We have something. Interruptions." She went on to describe them. "Look, do me a favor. Try to break them down into patterns. I mean, I know it's late and it's, what, 9 o'clock there, but if you..." "I think I understand you." Exhaling. "See if it fits Morse code." A quiet laugh. "I'll see, Gordon." He asked her to call him at home and gave her the number.
"I told you last week," Penny said. "We're going Air Cal to Oakland Saturday morning at 10 out of Lindbergh."
"I don't remember it."
"Oh, crap, I told you."
"Penny, I have a lot to do this weekend, a lot to think about."
"Think about it in Oakland."
"No, I can't. You can tell your parents we..." The telephone rang. "Claudia? Gordon? I checked, and you were right." A sudden hot dizziness swarmed over him. "What does it say?" "Those astronomical coordinates you told me about? That's all I have. They go on for pages."
"Great. That's just great. What is it, Gordon?"
"I don't know." They spoke for a few more moments. Claudia would keep their experiment running constantly. Signal strength seemed to come and go irregularly. Gordon listened, nodded, agreed. But his mind was not on the details. Instead, an odd sensation had begun to creep up through his legs and into his chest. He put down the telephone after saying goodnight and felt the hair rise on the back of his neck. It was real. All along, he had reserved a certain possibility that he was a potzer, that the experiment was wrong, that he was finding books in babbling brooks, as Penny once joked about it. But now he knew. Someone was trying to reach him.
"Gordon? Gordon, what is it?"
"Zins, New York." He looked up, dazed. "They found it." She kissed him, and together they did a little jig. No potzer he. Gordon lurched around the living room, barking jubilantly, "Ha!" and "Right!" After a moment, he felt dizzy and sat down. He was suddenly tired. Scratch one hypothesis, mark up one fact. But what should he do next? "Penny, you're right. We go to Oakland."
Chapter 35, 1998. A babble of conversation met Peterson as he opened the front door. Through the entrance to the drawing room across the stone hallway, he could see people talking rapidly. A burst of laughter, glasses clinking, a sugary swelling of the new Latin rhythms. He paused only an instant. Without looking to either side, he crossed the black and white squares of marble and went up the wide, curved staircase. It was generally true that people would not intercept you if you passed by quickly, not letting anyone catch your eyes. It was perfectly reasonable that he should be there. After all, it was his townhouse. A guest would assume he and Sarah together were putting on this bloody party, which he had forgotten, and that Peterson was tending to some domestic chore upstairs. He moved silently on the deep carpet and crossed the landing. The hall bathroom door showed a crack of light on the floor. Probably someone inside. He would be in the bedroom long enough for it to clear, but he should keep in mind the flow of traffic to and fro when he made his exit. He would have to go out the way he came in. To reach the rear exit through the kitchen, he would have to pass through the party. He closed the bedroom door and went to the closet. A rank of overcoats effectively concealed the two suitcases from anything short of a spring house cleaning. He pulled them out. A bit heavy, but manageable. He got them into position by the doorway and then gazed around. Opposite, the three long Georgian windows looked out onto a series of peaked roofs. Most buildings had dim rows of windows lit. It was the brownout hour, he recalled. Others were black. Zealous conservation, he wondered, or people who had left town already. No matter. He wasn't going to concern himself with such things any longer. Between the windows were full-length mirrors framed in brown velvet, which was in turn edged in black. Sarah's latest notion. Peterson hesitated, studying his reflection. Still a bit drawn, white around the eyes, but basically recovered. He had bluffed his way out of the hospital as soon as he felt able to move about. He had gone directly to his office. The council was in a full crisis state, and no one noticed him clearing certain documents from his files, placing a few last-minute orders by telephone, and giving certain instructions to his solicitor. Sir Martin had him in for an overview conference, and there Peterson saw his preparations were none too soon. The clouds were definitely carrying the bloom material far and wide. The cloud form was slightly different from the ocean form, but they shared the neurogenic effect Kiefer had found only a few days ago. Kiefer's data were of great use, but effective countermeasures were still a problem for the laboratories. The clouds dumped the stuff wherever they rained. Land plants generally resisted the neurojacket mechanism, but not always. Plant cellulose remained intact, but the more complex portions were vulnerable. Quick tests had turned up a method of cleansing certain plants to cut off the process before the stuff could diffuse through the plant skin. Washing the harvested crops in some solutions seemed feasible and promised a 70% success rate. Peterson thought wryly of Laura's, "Oh, the vegetables and everything are perfectly fresh, the finest. They're brought in from the country each day." Yes, and that's where he got the damn stuff. In the human digestive tract, it played hob with all sorts of metabolic processes, often fatally, if untreated. No one knew what the more subtle secondary effects on the food chain might be. There were some decidedly dark projections by the biologists. What's more, the cloud mechanism was spreading the bloom faster. Reddish dots were appearing in the North Atlantic now. With amazing energy, Sir Martin was marshalling the council resources. But even he seemed worried. They were dealing with an exponential process, and no one could say where the effect would saturate. Peterson looked around the room for one last time. Every feature in it was tailored for his habits, from the elegant accordion-like shoe rack to the artfully arranged bookshelf with its concealed communication center. A pity to leave it, really. But the whole point was to leave it before the rush, and yet have a plausible reason to be absent from the council for a few days. Recovering at some country hospital would do nicely. Sir Martin had studied him for a long moment when Peterson announced his departure, but that was an unavoidable risk. The two men probably understood each other quite well. A pity things couldn't have worked out better between them, Peterson thought, and edged open the bedroom door. A departing back, going down the stairs after a trip to the loo. Peterson waited until the man had vanished across the marble foyer. He shouldered open the door and carried the bags to the head of the stairs. Christ, they were heavy. He'd never allowed for the possibility that he might be ill when he had to make his move. He went down the stairs with soft thumps, taking the weight solidly and checking his balance before attempting the next step. He had to watch the footing intently. The stairway was immensely long. He began puffing. Latin music started abruptly, brassy and rich, flooding his ears and throwing off his concentration. Out of the corner of his eye, he sensed movement. A man and a woman approaching from the drawing room. He took the last three steps rapidly and nearly slipped on the slick floor. Ian, my, don't you look the traveller. I thought Sarah said you were in hospital. He thought rapidly. A smile. That was it. I still am, actually, he began, at the same time walking round the corner to a small tucked-in closet. He had to get the bags out of the way before anyone else came along. It's filling up, however, so I thought it best I get out of the public's way, go to a suburban place to recuperate, you know. Oh, Christ, yes, the man said. City hospitals are the worst. Can I help you with theirs? No, it's just a few clothes. He had scooted them into the closet and now closed the door firmly. I say, we were looking for a place, you know, to be private for a time. The woman looked at him expectantly. She was one of Sarah's friends, one of the sort he could never remember from one time to the next. She turned to gesture upstairs, no doubt thinking he had a thin imagination and needed a diagram. Her eye caught the door of his bedroom, standing open. Oh, that would be perfect. It has a lock, hasn't it? Peterson felt a cold anger. I'd rather think there might be... I shouldn't think we'd be long. You don't mind, do you? Yes, you do mind. He minds, Jeremy. She put one foot on the lower stair and looked at the man with her, clearly turning this difficult chap over to him. It really would be most obliging if you would give us some help here, Ian. Peterson felt suddenly hot and weak. He had to cut through all this, get free. He had reacted automatically to the idea of anyone using his bedroom for some stupid rutting. But now he saw that that was pointless. He had just now kissed the place goodbye, after all. Yes, I see. Go right ahead. I don't mind. He was able to say it almost cheerfully. The couple thanked him and moved up the staircase with what seemed to Peterson deliberate slowness. He glanced at the drawing room and took several deep, clearing breaths. He could get the bags and be gone without arousing comment, if only... Sarah... She had seen him as she passed by a knot of chattering people. As she tugged at a man, nodded towards Peterson. They crossed the squares of the foyer like chess pieces advancing. Knight errant and the queen to the attack, he thought. He noted remotely that she was wearing one of her own sleek dresses, a jungle print creation with a matching silk scarf tied round her head and hanging artfully to the left. He looked at the man with her and felt a cold shock. It was Prince Andrew. Jesus, she couldn't be starting that up again, could she? Well, it would hardly matter now. Ian, you're out already? Squisito, Sarah exclaimed, taking his hand. Just getting some things. They're transferring me to a place in the country. He extended a hand to Andrew. Good evening, sir. For heaven's sake, Ian, don't have to call me sir here. Andy's giving us invites to the coronation ball, the small one. Isn't that lovely of him? Yes, very. How's your brother faring, Andrew? Oh, I haven't seen him for a week myself. He's always busy now. Glad I don't have that job. He's better suited to it than the rest of us, anyway. Oh, I'm sure you could do magnificently, Sarah murmured. Andrew shook his head in a wobbly way. No, I doubt it. I've often wondered whether it was just luck that the heir turned out that way, or whether he turned out that way precisely because he was the heir. Peterson suppressed a fidgeting motion with his hands and tried to think of something to say. Was this conversation unreal, or was it just him? He takes his work very seriously, he said blandly. The times I've consulted with him, he's gone right to the point. Got a sense of humour, though, you know, Andrew replied as though apologising for his brother's seriousness. He blinked owlishly. Peterson realised that Andrew was drunk in precisely the degree that royalty can get drunk without arousing comment. That was to say, quite a bit. Sarah tugged at Peterson's sleeve, beckoning him into the party. He considered for an instant, and then followed. He wanted no one to notice the size or weight of the cases he carried as he left. Best to get Sarah and Andrew back into the mob and slip away later. He allowed Sarah to parade him around, introducing him to a few new people he could spot as being potentially useful to her. He smiled, nodded, said little. Gradually it dawned on him that everyone there was addled in some way, drunk, high on drugs, or simply hysterical with frenetic energy. And they were all talking the most superficial rubbish as well. He'd expected a barrage of questions on the bloom or the clouds, but absolutely no one asked. He found himself watching them from a distance, as elegant and ignorant as swans. Yet he knew some of them must have doubts. Again, the sensation of unreality. It took well over an hour before he saw his chance. He wanted to be damn sure Andrew didn't see the bags, so he waited until Sarah was clinging to Andrew's arm and had just set into one of her stock outrageous stories. Then Peterson slipped through several babbling groups, seeming to be among them, but in fact listening to nothing, watching only to see if anyone important saw his exit. At the right moment, he moved quickly into the foyer. Out came the bags. As he turned, his own bedroom door opened and a bleary, reddened face appeared. Before the woman could hail him, he wrenched open the outer door and fled. Not the smooth departure he had envisioned, but good enough. Ahead lay Cambridge, and then, by God, he could rest. Chapter 36. Marjorie sat in the Markham small rented house and watched Jan. She had come expecting to play the gentle, efficient helper to a distraught and grieving friend, but found their roles almost reversed. Jan was packing systematically. Marjorie had offered to do it for her. She felt that Jan should probably have the freedom to sprawl face down on her bed, face into her pillow, if she felt like it. Jan had refused her help, saying she wouldn't be able to find things if she didn't pack them herself. Marjorie had offered to make her some tea. Strong, sweet tea soothed anyone. But Jan hadn't wanted that either. She went on working. Marjorie, slightly offended, thought she might even start humming a tune as she worked. Marjorie wished Jan would offer a drink. Abruptly, she clamped down on that thought. God, it was still early in the morning. "Isn't there anything I can do?" she asked with a thin tone of desperation. Jan stopped and pushed a strand of hair back from her eyes. "Well, come to think of it, you could pack up Greg's clothes. Why don't you just take this big box and go upstairs? Just his clothes and shoes. I'm going to try and sell them to the second-hand shop on Petit Curry. Oh, and check the whole closet. I think his raincoat's in there. And his robe is on the back of the bathroom door." She gave a sideways smile. "You may as well check all the rooms. I never broke him of the habit of dropping his things wherever he happened to be." Marjorie stared at her, disbelieving. She herself had carefully avoided mentioning Greg's name. "How can you be so calm?" she burst out. Jan considered. "I think it's because there's so much to do. I haven't had time to break down. Don't worry, Marjorie. It will hit me sooner or later. I suppose I haven't really taken it in yet." Marjorie noticed that Jan packed her clothing in a strict ritual. Skirts first, folded carefully, lengthwise, and then at the hip. Hose in neat little balls. Jan concentrated on her task with absolute energy. She laid out blouses with precisely defined movements, the sleeves in stiff parallels. She fastened the buttons at the collars and down the front, fingers working rhythmically. The arms folded over. She deftly set the creases, smoothed wrinkles. The soft cloth made neat rectangles, each a package. Jan lined them up in a suitcase, tucking in corners. The lid closed snug and tight. "Would you like to stay with us until you can get a flight? I don't feel you should be alone here. I'll be all right. I'm going to London to line up for a flight. There's evidence that Greg's flight picked up some virulent form of the cloud stuff. They think that's what happened to the pilot. No telling, of course. But it means the airlines are scheduling very little until the council lifts that limitation on flights. They've cancelled everything that might cross the really thick clouds. Jan shrugged. You're sure you should go home? To California? Might as well. A wan fatigue crept into Jan's face. I'm no use here. I still think you should stay with us a bit. The children are home. The school's closed, you know, and we could have picnics and... No, I'm sorry, no. Thanks, though. Jan picked up the box. She stared into it for a moment. I hope I make it. Renfrew paced the lab floor, smacking one fist into the other palm. His assistant Jason leaned against a grey cabinet, staring moodily at the floor. Where's George? Renfrew asked suddenly. Home, sick. Well, I suppose it doesn't matter. There's nothing we can do anyway. Damn power failures. And I still haven't been able to reach Peterson. His secretary says he's ill. What a time to choose to be ill. He paced some more. The roughing pumps stood silent around him. The lab was gloomy, lit only by a skylight. Late afternoon sunlight slanted in. God, Markham would have been back here tomorrow, and we'd have had the Brookhaven backing. Who's going to speak for us now?
Mr. Peterson said he was prepared to help the last time he was here.
I don't trust that fellow, but if I could at least get in touch with him. God damn it.
He went over to the water fountain and pressed the button. Nothing happened. He kicked it.
I never thought I'd live to see water rationing in England, he said. And it's raining cats and dogs, too. Water, water everywhere, and not a drop to drink. I remember learning that one at school. And slimy things did crawl with legs upon the slimy sea. Yes, he snorted. It'll be the Red Cliffs of Dover soon.
Why don't you go home? Jason suggested. I'll stick here in case there's a call from London.
Home? Renfrew said vaguely.
Once Marjorie had been the first person to turn to in times of stress. Her capable motherly presence and simple optimism had always reassured him. But now she was edgy and nervous all the time. He suspected she was drinking too much. He'd mentioned as much to her once, but she'd flown off the handle, so he hadn't brought it up again. Her innate good sense would pull her through, he was sure. And the kids? He hadn't even seen them, except briefly for a month. They got up late since there was no school, so he didn't even see them at breakfast. Yes, perhaps he should go home. Try to make contact with his family again. Leaving the lab, he found that someone had cut through the chain and stolen his bicycle. It was evening and dark by the time he got home. He stood wearily on the porch and shook the rain off his coat. His key turned in the lock. But the door was chained on the inside. He rattled it, but no one came. He pressed the bell, realizing as he did so that there were no lights on in the house, so the bell wouldn't work either. Turning up his coat collar, he left the shelter of the porch and squished round to the back. The kitchen door was locked too. Peering through the window, he saw Marjorie sitting at the table in the flickering candlelight. He rapped on the windowpane. She looked up, screamed. The candle went out and there was a crash. Marjorie! He shouted. Marjorie, it's me, John! A thumping. The chain rattled. She opened the back door.
Don't do that, she complained. My God, you almost gave me a heart attack. Now I can't find the damn candle. It fell on the floor somewhere.
She locked the door behind him.
I'll get another one.
In the dark, he heard her fumbling round, banging cupboard doors. His feet crunched on what sounded like broken glass on the floor. He smelled whiskey. She never used to drink whiskey. A match burst orange. One candlelight sent their shadows leaping up the kitchen walls. "Why in heaven's name don't you use more than one candle?" he asked. "Because you can be sure that it'll be the next thing the country will run out of." "Where are the kids?" "Good heavens, John, they're at my brother's. I told you that. They were just trailing around here, twiddling their thumbs, so I thought they'd have more fun with their cousins. They can help the harvest, if the rain doesn't completely wipe it out." She bent to pick up the pieces of broken glass from the floor. He started to ask her if there was anything for dinner, then tactfully reworded it. "Have you eaten yet?" "No." She gave a little giggle. "I drank my dinner instead. It saves trouble." The giggle reminded him of the old bouncy Marjorie. With a strange surge of feeling, he reached out and took her hands. "Damn!" he jerked back, sucking his thumb where a splinter of glass had cut him. "You silly bugger," she said unsympathetically. "You could see what I was doing." She threw the piece of glass into the trash and wiped the floor with a sponge. "You never used to drink whiskey," he said, watching her. "It's quicker. I know what you're thinking. You're afraid I'm becoming an alcoholic. But I know when to stop. I just drink enough to take the edge off things." "Well, how about some food, then?" "Help yourself," she shrugged. "You could open a tin of beans and heat it on the gas ring. Or there's some cheese in the larder." "You know, it's not a whole lot of fun to come home on a rainy night to a cold, dark house, and not even any dinner." "I don't see how you can blame me because it's cold and dark. What am I supposed to do? Burn the furniture? And it's the first time you've come home this early in God knows how long, and since you didn't let me know, you could hardly expect to find dinner ready, John. You have no idea how awful it is to shop for food these days. You have to queue up for hours, literally, and then there's practically nothing to be had anyway."
"I don't know, Marjorie. You always used to be so resourceful. We ought to be better off than most people. We could kill a chicken, and then there's your vegetable garden."
"God, John, sometimes I feel as if you've been away for months. The chickens were stolen weeks ago, all of them. I know I told you. As for the vegetables, am I supposed to go slopping around there in the rain looking for a leftover potato or two? It's the end of September. The garden's a swamp now, anyway."
The lights came back on suddenly. The refrigerator whirred. They blinked. Two people confronted with each other without the shadowy softenings. A silence fell. John fidgeted.
"Heather's mother died," she said abruptly. "Well, it's a happy release. Not like Greg Markham. God, that was a shock. It's hard to believe he's dead. He seemed so, well, so alive. And Heather and James lost their jobs, you know."
"Don't tell me any more bad news," he said gruffly, and disappeared into the larder.
Chapter 37. Marjorie hoped John would be home soon. He had worked past midnight every night this week. She ran a hand through her hair, eyed her empty glass. Better not. She'd had three already. Was this how one became an alcoholic? She got up suddenly, turned on the radio and the stereo at high volume. A cacophony of sound blared through the room, a jazz band clashing against a trio of Latin singers, bringing a kind of life. She went through the ground floor again, turning on all the lights. Conservation be damned. Her nerves were jumping, and she was having a little difficulty focusing her eyes. After all, what was there to stay sober for? She picked up her glass and headed for the sideboard. Halfway across the room, she stopped, catching some half-heard sound. Lottie was barking furiously shut up in the laundry room. She hesitated, then turned down the radio and stereo.
This time it was, unmistakably, the front doorbell. She stood in the middle of the room. Who would... The doorbell rang again. Then a knock. How silly of her. As if a prowler would knock at the door. It was probably a friend. Yes, thank God, someone to talk to, spend the evening with. She hurried to the hall, turned on the porch light. Through the stained glass window to the left of the door, she saw the silhouette of a man. Panic seized her again. Distant thunder growled. She took a deep breath, then leaned against the door and called out, as calmly as she could manage, "Who is it?" "Ian Peterson." She stared blankly at the door for a moment, mind a blur. She slowly slid back the chain and the two bolts and opened the door a crack. His hair was ruffled. His jacket showed wrinkles, and he wore no tie. A wave of embarrassment ran over her as she realized what a sight she must present, too, with her hair awry, clutching an empty glass in one hand and dressed, for God's sake, in a tatty old sundress because it was so hot. She smoothed her dress with one sticky hand and tried to hide the glass behind her with the other. "Oh, Mr. Peterson. Well, I'm afraid John isn't here. He is working in the lab this evening." "Oh, I was hoping to catch him here." "Well, I'm sure you could go around." A sudden wind howled across the yard, blowing leaves over Peterson's shoulders. "Oh," Marjorie exclaimed. Peterson automatically stepped inside. She slammed the door. "My word, what a gust. Storm coming. How was it on the road?" "Difficult. I've been laid up, actually, in a hotel south of here for several days. After I recovered, I decided to take a run by here to see if John has anything new." "Well, I think not, Mr. Peterson. He... Ian, please." "Well, Ian, John's been scrounging fuel for the power supply the laboratory has. He says he can't rely on commercial service any longer. That's been taking his time. He's continuing to transmit, I can tell you that." Peterson nodded. "Good. I suppose that is all anyone can expect. It was an interesting experiment." He smiled. "I suppose I half believed it could be done, you know." "But can't it still? I mean, I think there's something we don't understand about the process. I must admit, I was for the most part interested in the work simply because it was a good bit of science in its own right. A last indulgence of mine, I suppose. Playing cards on the Titanic. I've had a chance to think this over the last few days. I left London thinking I was all right, and then the illness hit me again. I tried to get into a hospital and was rejected. No rooms. So I stayed in a hotel, riding out the last side effects. Take no food. That's the cure. So I thought about the experiment to distract myself." "My word. Do come and sit." Marjorie saw as he moved into the light that Peterson was pale and thinner. There was a sunken, hollow look about his eyes. "This illness, was it?" "Yes, the cloud-carried thing. Even after they clear it from your system, there are residual metabolic irregularities." "We've been eating tinned food. The radio says that's best." Peterson grimaced. "Yes, they would say that. It means they haven't the treating fluids they need to save the present crop. I telephoned my sec today and learned quite a few little gems I suppose they haven't told the public." "Is it bad?" "Bad? No. Disastrous." He sank wearily onto the sofa. "No matter how much you plan for it, the real thing seems curiously, well, unreal." "I thought we hadn't planned for this." He blinked as if orienting himself. "Well, no, I meant the endless projection, so mathematical. Not this way." He shook his head and went on. "I advise you to eat as little as possible. I have a suspicion, and so do the experts, sod them for all they know, the effects of this will change our lives utterly. There's a shortage of the system-flushing drugs we need, and some think the biosphere is going to be permanently altered." Well, yes, she said worriedly, feeling a strange sensation wash through her. If you fellows can't... Peterson seemed to pull himself back from the mood that had struck him. Well, let's not dwell on it, shall we, Marjorie? I may call you Marjorie. Of course. And how are you feeling? To tell you the truth, I'm just a bit squiffy. I was nervous here on my own, and I had a couple of drinks. I'm afraid they go to my head, rather.
Well, that's probably the best way to be. May I get myself a drink and catch up a bit?
Please do. Can you help yourself? I hardly even know what we've got. I'm drinking Pernod. She watched him cross the room. While his back was turned, she felt free to stare at him. He squatted lightly before the sideboard, tilting the bottles to read their labels. She leaned her head in her hand. She was aware of him coming back across the room, stopping by her, crouching.
You sure you're all right, Marjorie?
She couldn't meet his eyes. She knew she was blushing. His hand rested on the arm of her chair. She looked at his gold watch, the slender wrist, the dark hair on the back of his pale hand. She felt unable to move. She stared at the hand.
Marjorie?
I'm sorry. I feel terribly hot, Ian. Well, let me open a window. It is very stuffy in here. The hand disappeared from view, and presently she felt air cooling her damp forehead. Oh, that's better. Thank you. She leaned back, was able to look at him. After all, he was not so very special. Good-looking, but not strikingly so. She smiled back at him. I'm sorry, I'm a bit weird this evening. There's been this cloud thing, and then Greg Markham, and... Well, things can seem pointless. And yet one is glad to be alive. I'm sorry, I'm not making much sense, am I? It's just that we're so powerless. I keep wanting to do something.
You're making a lot of sense, Marjorie.
Thunder crashed suddenly, shaking the house. Christ, that was close, she exclaimed, and then was taken aback at herself. She mustn't be so excitable. A prickly wave rushed over her skin. I wonder if more of those cloud organisms are coming down in this rain.
Probably.
There was a local woman, I heard, who kept a home for cats. She gave all her own tinned food to the cats, thinking the boxed food she had for them had been contaminated. I expect she'll starve.
Mad.
He took a substantial pull on his drink. Did you hear about the coronation? They've cancelled preparations. Peterson said sarcastically.
Aye, I expect the country will be in an uproar over that.
Marjorie smiled. A flash, then a booming crash of thunder. Marjorie leapt up in fright. They looked at each other and abruptly burst out laughing.
As long as you can hear it, you're safe, he said.
By that time, the lightning's passed. Suddenly, she felt very good. She was glad to have him there, keeping loneliness and fear at bay. Are you hungry? Would you like something to eat?
No, I'm not. Relax, don't play the hostess. If I want anything, I'll get it.
He smiled wanly at her. Was there a double entendre in his words? He must be used to getting anything he wanted. Tonight, though, he was less certain. More... It's good to see you, she said. It's been pretty lonely here recently, with the children away and John working late.
Yes, I imagine.
He didn't finish the sentence. The lights went out, dramatically accompanied by a roll of thunder. Now I'm really glad you're here. I'd be scared stiff on my own, thinking someone had cut the lines to the house or something.
Oh, I'm sure it's just a power failure.
Lines blown down by the wind, probably. Well, that's been happening a lot recently. I've got some candles in the kitchen. She crossed the room, skirting the furniture in the dark from long familiarity. In the kitchen, she felt in the cupboard for candles and matches. Automatically, she lit three and set them in candlesticks. The mechanical clock on a shelf went tick, followed by a clacking as gears moved. She turned and found Ian in the doorway. He stepped inside. The clock made a sound like a ratchet sticking.
"Oh, I fetched that out of the garage while straightening up," she said. "With the power always off, an old wind-up is better."
Tick.
"Makes that odd sound, though, doesn't it? Perhaps if you oiled it." "But I did, you see. There's something needs mending. It stays pretty near right, though."
He leaned against the counter and watched her put away the matches. She noticed that the pine shelving loomed up in the shadows cast by the candles. Things in the room waved and rippled, except for the straight shelves. Tick.
"Interesting," Ian murmured. "How we keep on wanting to know the time in the midst of all that's going on."
"Yes. As if we still had appointments to keep."
"Yes."
A silence stretched between them. A chasm. She searched for something to say. Tick. The shelves seemed more substantial now than the walls. The clock nested in the middle of them, surrounded by preserves. She looked at Ian. In this dim light, his eyes were very dark. She leaned against the cupboard, less nervous now. She should take the candles into the living room, but for the moment, it felt right to stay here, not hurry. Ian moved across the small kitchen. Distantly, she wondered if he was going to take a candle. Tick. He reached up and touched her cheek. Neither of them moved. She felt warm. She took a shallow breath. She breathed in, and it seemed to take a long time to fill her lungs. Very slowly, he bent and kissed her. It was a light, almost casual touch. She sagged against the cupboard. Tick. She breathed out. In the silence, she wondered if he could hear the air flowing in and out of her. She watched as he picked up a candle. A hand touched her shoulder. He steered her out, away from the kitchen and shelves and clock, towards the living room.
This ends side 2 of cassette 9 of Timescape. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 10.